This is Sean Fothingham, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading for Are We There Yet? A quirky travel guide to the Southwest and beyond. Christmas in the Southwest is a special time. While we may not have much in the way of snow, we make up for it with Christmas spirit. Just because we may not need to knit scarves and gloves on the way to Grandma's house, it doesn't mean we still don't feel the cool, crisp Christmas chill in the air. There's a variety of Southwest Christmas traditions we still carry out to this day. One prominent tradition is the hanging of ristres. Ristres are, traditionally, a means to dry and store chili peppers, garlic, or other vegetables to use later in the year. They've taken hold throughout the American Southwest as a common decorative item during the holiday season. They're found adorning doorways and hanging from fences all year round, and around Christmas, expect to see more than a few decked with both red and green peppers, or arranged as pequin wreaths. Ristres are also thought to bring health and good luck. We are most likely to pick up chili ristres or chili pequin wreaths from local farmers markets, but if you're a southerner looking for your first ristre, you can get one on Amazon for only $39.95. I'm sure your Amazon shopping cart is full of Christmas decorations, but if you're looking to tap into your southwestern roots, we recommend showing off your chili ristre. I don't know about you, but all this chili talk is making me crave red chili sauce and Mexican cuisine. The bizcochito is by no means relegated to Christmas. You can find them year-round just about anywhere. However, these crisp buttery cookies, given just the right amount of spice with flavors of anise and cinnamon, are a staple sweet no Southwestern Christmas is complete without. It seems that no holiday meal in the Southwest, Thanksgiving, Christmas, or otherwise, finishes without tamales on the table. A traditional dish through much of the Americas, tamales are made with masa, or dough, and a variety of fillings. Cheese, meat, fruit, or vegetables are common, wrapped in corn husk and steamed. Making tamales the right way is a time-consuming and labor-intensive process, making it perfect for the holidays, when family and friends can be easily recruited to help lend a set of hands. Empanadas, from the Spanish to wrap in bread, are flaky, delicious handheld pastries stuffed with filling. While they can be made with savories like meat or veggies, around the holidays in the Southwest, expect plenty of apple, cherry, and pumpkin empanadas to be passed your way. Despite the hotly contested debate over the proper name, farolito, little lantern, versus luminaria, festival light, these festive holiday lanterns are guaranteed to brighten any Southwestern Christmas. Small paper bags are weighted down with sand, and a tea light is placed inside. Luminarias have for centuries in New Mexico lighted the way along paths to the local church, symbolically lighting the way for the Holy Family. Today, the tradition has spread far and wide, from California to Maine. The sight of hundreds of them glowing along walkways, eaves, and pathways is a holiday sight you'll not soon forget. Around the holidays, many regions with large Mexican-American and Catholic populations observe the holiday by reenacting Los Pastores and Las Posadas. Los Pastores, the pastors, is a popular Mexican nativity play. This community play tells of the incarnation of the Lord, the coming of the shepherds and kings. Community members are usually asked to take on the roles: St. Joseph, the Blessed Virgin, the infant, the three kings, a good angel, and a bad angel. And following the play, community members and actors sing, dance, and feast together. Las Posadas, the inns, is actually a Christmas novena, a special form of worship that takes place over the course of 9 days. During Las Posadas, which begins on December 16th, 19 homes and families are selected to serve as the posadas, or inns. Each night for 9 nights, ending on Christmas Eve, the families form a procession, stopping at each of the 9 inns. Along the way, They carry candles and sing the story of Mary and Joseph traveling to Bethlehem. On the first 8 nights, the family of the inn has to turn away the procession, as there is no lodging, though not before the procession takes a tour of the rooms in song. On the final night, however, they are welcomed into the home where a Christmas crib and manger has been set up, often along with plenty of refreshments for the weary travelers. Sure, we may have a good old-fashioned Christmas tree indoors like the rest of you, but true Southwesterners go all out, and they certainly aren't going to let a few stickers stop them. It's a common sight around the holidays to see saguaros, prickly pear, yucca, ocotillo, heck, even tumbleweeds, decorated very carefully with twinkling lights. The Southwest's rich agricultural history comes together with Christmas tradition in this truly Texas decoration, barbed wire wreaths, spotted all over during the holidays. The trappings of a traditional American Christmas include wrapped presents under a decorated fir or spruce tree, pumpkin pie, and the singing of Christmas carols and stockings hung by the chimney with care. But if you live in or visit as a snowbird the southwestern deserts for the holidays, you'll notice that the season is celebrated with a regional twist. Join in the fun with some few simple decoration tips. A tumbleweed tree. Starting with a decorated tree in the desert, the tree can be styled from the ubiquitous Russian thistle, more commonly known as the tumbleweed. A single large tumbleweed secured to a solid base, such as in a box of sand, becomes a tree. To decorate, first wrap the tree with brightly colored ribbons to which you can add glitter, curl them with the blade of a scissors, and wind them through the tree branches. Include a string of popcorn or red pyracantha berries. Make ornaments by drawing Native American petroglyphs on various shapes cut out of colorful art paper or shiny foil. Scour the desert around you for unique objects as well to use as ornaments. These could be small pieces of twisted wood from desert plants and the skeletal parts of dead cacti to hang on the tree. Use water-based paint or felt-tip markers to draw designs or to color the other treasures you find for your Southwest desert holidays. Mexican Christmas traditions, as celebrated in the southwestern deserts, are very different from those involving Santa Claus and Christmas trees. Christmas in Mexico is influenced by Spanish culture, such as the lighting of luminarias, which are candles set in sand at the bottom of a common paper lunch bag and placed along walkways, much as you would use solar lights. Red poinsettia flowers have also become a tradition in the Southwest, where groupings of them often replace the traditional Christmas tree. Piñatas, made of paper and filled with candy treats, are also a well-known Mexican custom. At Christmas parties, the most typical piñata is the Christmas star, and children will put on a blindfold and take turns hitting the piñata with a stick until it bursts and the candy shower down to the floor to be shared by everyone. And don't forget eating. Tamales are particularly popular at Christmas time and will often be served as part of dinner on Christmas Eve. Why are some traditions repeated year after year at Christmas? Here are some reasons behind the traditions that have been held dear for centuries. Origin. Mention of celebrating the birth of Christ did not appear in church literature until 200 CE, and there are two theories as to why December 25th was chosen. Biblical Archaeology Review. The most noted reason is that the date was borrowed as a substitute for pagan celebrations taking place during that time of the year. This was suggested in the 12th century. The second is that December 25th is 9 months after March 25th, which is the Feast of the Annunciation, or the commemoration of Jesus' conception. Jesus was believed to have been conceived and crucified on the same day of the year. This second reasoning seems to have existed in the 200s. The 12 days of Christmas, the period between December 25th and January 6th, Epiphany. The Nativity Set. Saint Francis of Assisi created the first living nativity in 1223 because he wanted to enact the birth of Christ in all of its impoverished glory. Before this, mangers bedecked in jewels and gold were set out in churches to represent the king who lay there. Living nativity enactments continue to this day, and there are many different types of sets available for purchase. Many people display the entire set throughout the season, but others try to be more realistic by adding certain characters on certain dates. For example, they place baby Jesus in the manger on Christmas Day and add the wise men around Epiphany. The legend of Santa Claus is derived from the beneficent character of Bishop Nicholas of Smyrna, who lived in the 4th century AD in what is now modern Turkey. Bishop Nicholas used to give gifts to poor children to encourage them. Bishop Nicholas was later named as a saint and became the patron saint of children and seafarers. Hanging a wreath at Christmas is also a centuries-old tradition. Most wreaths are circular, and the circle has long been symbolic of the unbroken span of eternity, as well as the circular nature of life itself. Used in mid-December at the time of the winter solstice, the circle symbolizes a certainty that the endless cycle of seasons will once again bring the return of light, Elizabeth Ginsburg wrote on naturehills.com. Both the Romans and the Germans used this tradition in their homes, and early Christians adopted it as a symbol of life and eternity. Since ancient times, people have been using greenery to brighten their homes during winter to remind them that spring was coming and to stave off evil spirits and sickness. In 19th century Germany, devout Christians brought decorated trees into their homes as a symbol of hope and faith. It is also said that Protestant reformer Martin Luther first used candles on his Christmas tree after taking inspiration on a starlit evening. Christmas trees became popular in America after German-born Prince Albert, Queen Victoria of England, and their family posed before a Christmas tree for a newspaper sketch. Because Queen Victoria was so popular, fashion-conscious East Coast observers brought the concept to America. According to allthingschristmas.com, legend has it that holly plants sprang up from the earth wherever Christ stepped. The pointed leaves were said to represent the crown of thorns Christ wore while on the cross, and the red berries symbolized the blood he shed. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care, Clement Clark Moore wrote in his famous poem, The Night Before Christmas. But why? This story comes from ancient times when the generous St. Nicholas heard the plight of three young women whose mother had died and their father could not afford a dowry so that they could get married. The young women, who did all of their own chores, used to hang their stockings by the fire to dry. One night, while the family was sleeping, St. Nicholas placed a bag of gold into each one, thus giving the father enough money to afford a marriage for each daughter. Since then, children have been hanging Christmas stockings in hopes that St. Nicholas soon would be there. Mistletoe has always been revered because it had no roots and stayed green all winter. Ancient cultures believed that mistletoe had magical healing powers and used it as an antidote for poison, infertility, and to ward off evil spirits. The Romans saw the plant as a symbol of peace, and Scandinavians associated the plant with Frigga, their goddess of love. Those who kissed under the mistletoe had the promise of happiness and good luck in the following year. The sweet candy canes have been around since the 17th century, despite what anyone tells you about a candy maker from Indiana who wanted to create a candy that symbolized his faith. It's a nice story, but that's all that it is. Folks from Europe began decorating their Christmas trees with cookies and candy confections, including straight white sugary sticks called candy canes. The red stripes were not added until the 20th century. The one religious connection may be found in a legend that says that candy canes were shaped into crooks to represent the shepherds. These crooks were passed out to children during the Living Nativity scene at the request of the choir master at the Cologne Cathedral in Germany, so that they would be quiet. Should Christians be alarmed when the term Xmas is used? Absolutely not. The letter X represents the Greek letter chi, which is the first letter in the Greek word for Christ. The symbol is similar to the letter X in the modern Roman alphabet. The usage is nearly as old as Christianity itself, according to Snopes.com. We happily hoist our eggnog in the air, embrace each other, and raise our out-of-tune voices in song. And we have no idea what in Santa's name we're singing. Each holiday season, the masses carol about figgy pudding and gay apparel and someone named Parson Brown, mostly ignorant to the meaning of these antiquated phrases and references to things long past. In the spirit of finding the true meaning of Christmas, we thought it best to find the true meaning of these befuddling Christmas song lyrics. Here, a glossary to the most confusing. Oh, bring us a figgy pudding. Whether carolers would truly like for someone to bring them some figgy pudding, as they demand in We Wish You a Merry Christmas, depends on their fondness for another classic holiday dessert. It's a little bit like fruitcake, baking expert Dory Greenspan told NPR's Michelle Norris on All Things Considered. I was afraid to say it because fruitcake has such a bad reputation. But figgy pudding is steamed. It's chock-a-block with dried fruits. It's so boozy, it's delicious. It was popularized as a holiday dessert in 16th century England and also known as Christmas pudding or plum pudding. Over the years, its popularity has waned significantly. A holly jolly Christmas. I don't know if there'll be snow, but have a cup of cheer. There's a cute play on words going on here. It's Christmas, bucko, so look happy. But as some of us know all too well, cup of cheer refers more specifically to a brimming cup of holiday happy juice, booze. Whether it's spiked eggnog, mulled cider, or some other libation, the narrator here is inviting listeners to raise a glass, drink, and be merry. It'll nearly be like a picture print by Currier and Ives. Currier and Ives was a printmaking firm based out of New York City from 1834 to 1907. Founded by Nathaniel Currier, who later partnered with James Merritt Ives, the firm described itself as publishers of cheap and popular prints, most of which were lithographs depicting the spectrum of American life. Extremely popular were the winter landscapes, which featured utopian winter scenes of couples riding horse-drawn carriages through the snow or families ice skating on picturesque ponds. In Sleigh Ride, the narrator is painting a scene so perfect that it could be featured on an iconic Currier and Ives print. In the meadow, we can build a snowman, then pretend that he is Parson Brown. This one line in Winter Wonderland has stopped countless people dead in their tracks. Who is Parson Brown, and why are these people making a snowman that looks like him? Given that, in 1934, when the song was written, the most famous Parson Brown was a Florida orange grower, lyricist Richard B. Smith was likely referring to a fictional pastor. During that period, Protestant ministers were called parsons and would travel from town to town to perform weddings for couples who didn't have a local minister of their faith where they lived. So those lyrics are actually a bit flirtatious. The narrator is suggesting that they build a snowman that looks like a minister. The next lines, he'll say, "Are you married?" "We'll say no, man, but you can do the job while you're in town," could be considered a mock proposal. "Don we now our gay apparel, fa-la-la-la-la-la-la-la." "Deck the halls" was written back in the 16th century when the English language was very different. Modern translation, "Put on your party clothes." "A pair of hop-along boots and a pistol that shoots" is the wish of Barney and Ben. A pair of hop-along boots kicks off the list of Christmas presents for pairs of children that are rattled off in It's Beginning to Look a Lot Like Christmas. The boots in question have no particular spring or bounce. The song refers to popular costume boots from the 40s and 50s, modeled after the ones worn by the cowboy Hopalong Cassidy in a series of books and films. Originally conceived by author Clarence E. Mulford in 1904, Hopalong was crude, rough-talking, and dangerous. For the 66 film starring William Boyd that came out in the 30s and 40s before rerunning on TV and finding an even wider audience in the 50s, Hopalong was rebranded a clean-cut, valiant hero, and his boots were the prize of little boys everywhere. "Impress all your friends on New Year's Eve, everyone. Auld Lang Syne is Scottish Gaelic for old long since, or more idiomatically, days gone by or time long past." Every holiday season, families around the world trim their trees, sing carols, and hang their stockings in hopes that they'll find them filled with goodies by Christmas morning. However, for all the quaint and sometimes corny customs we follow today, there are just as many weird Christmas traditions that have been cast by the wayside, falling out of favor and being remembered less and less each year. You've no doubt read Clement Clark Moore's iconic 1823 poem, "'Twas the Night Before Christmas," which includes the line, "The children were nestled all snug in their beds, while visions of sugar plums danced in their heads." But have you ever stopped to think about what a sugar plum actually is? Originally, these were caraway seeds or cardamom pods, some kind of spice that was then coated in sugar. Modern holiday recipes involving dried fruits or nuts are actually not at all authentic. In this case, the word plum comes from its non-fruit-related usage, meaning desirable, such as in the term plum job. Fruitcake has gotten a bad rap as of late, but placing fruitcake under your pillow actually has some pretty sweet origins. If you ate a piece of fruitcake, especially if it was from a wedding, and put the remainder under your pillow at night, legend said you dream of the person you will marry. And this isn't the only antiquated Christmas tradition involving love. Christmas revelers in the 17th century would also do things like throw food at the wall to see if what stuck spelled out the name of a lover. They'd also toss shoes into a tree, and if they hung there, the thrower would be married within the year. Today, English royalty continues to serve fruitcake at the Christmastime gatherings as a nod to tradition. In 12th century France, a donkey would be led in a procession through the center of town to the local church when a service was in session. The donkey would remain next to the church's altar for the duration of the service, and congregants would mimic its bray in a call and response with the priest. This tradition, known as the Feast of the Donkey, was accompanied by raucous parties that usually got out of hand. The celebration became such a problem that many towns eventually had to ban it. Derived from the influence of Roman Saturnalia celebrations, social inversion was a popular Christmastime practice centuries ago. This would typically involve the election of a boy bishop, or child, to run the church in lieu of a minister during the Feast of St. Nicholas on December 6th. In the most extreme examples, you'd wind up with some 3-year-old running around leading the whole thing. Today, the Christmas season runs from Thanksgiving to Christmas Day, but that wasn't always the case. Before, it was the other way around. The months leading up to Christmas were considered Advent, which, similar to Lent, was considered a time of restraint for Christians. Instead, Christmas season was from Christmas until the eve of the Epiphany on January 6. And the biggest celebrations were actually held on that final day, known as Twelfth Night, which served as the inspiration for William Shakespeare's play of the same name. Many games and Christmas traditions were once held on Twelfth Night, and one of those traditions was to bake a cake and hide something in it, like a string bean or a coin, which is similar to the modern tradition of finding a bean or figurine in a king cake served on Mardi Gras in the South. Whoever found the item in their slice of cake on Twelfth Night would lead the evening's festivities. Wearing costumes used to be a traditional part of the Christmas celebration. In one famous instance, a group of 13th century nobles burned to death when the tar on their four savages' costumes caught on fire. King Charles, meanwhile, narrowly escaped the incident, and the practice was henceforth banned within his court. Caroling used to look a lot more like trick-or-treating. In fact, in 19th century Europe, it was an occasion for poor folks to request gifts from wealthy landowners. They'd go from house to house and say, "Okay, we're going to sing you a song, and you can either invite us in for food or drink. But if you don't, you never know what's going to happen to your yard." Yikes! In this song, "It's the Most Wonderful Time of the Year," you'll hear the line, "There'll be scary ghost stories and tales of the glories," and may wonder why there would be scary ghost stories on Christmas. In addition, you might be curious as to why A Christmas Carol, one of the most famous Christmas stories of all time, is a ghost story. Well, the Victorians, who helped cement many of our modern American ideas of Christmas, loved scary stories. In fact, A Christmas Carol was far from the only Christmas-themed ghost story Charles Dickens wrote. Yes, Christmas was once more spooky and scary rather than warm and fuzzy. And it wasn't just ghost stories that once made Christmas the most eerie time of year. There used to be a huge supernatural component to Christmas. For example, in some parts of Europe, it was believed that supernatural activity was at a high on Christmas Eve, sort of the way it is on the Day of the Dead. Additionally, in Germany and Poland, if a child was born on Christmas Eve, they were considered more likely to be a werewolf. In 1938, Coca-Cola and artist Haddon Sundblom decided to depict Santa as a 6-foot, full-grown human grandfather. Due to their massive marketing budget, Coke's version of Santa Claus spread far and wide and soon became the standard image of Santa throughout the United States and much of Europe. Before that, however, descriptions of Santa were all over the map. This included variations of Santa as an elf and a gnome. In fact, much of the time he wasn't depicted as fully human at all. Prior to the modern adoption of reindeer and elves in Santa Nick's mythology, Santa's helpers were a little more sinister. Instead, he would have these gruff characters that walk around with him and dole out punishment. This included the menacing Krampus, a horned goat demon who punishes naughty children and whose presence on Christmas is still recognized in Austria, Hungary, Slovenia, and Slovakia. This superstitious Christmas tradition has fallen out of favor in recent years, but first footing was the belief that the first person to cross the threshold of a home on Christmas Eve is considered good luck, especially if it was a dark-haired gentleman. It was typically observed in England and Scotland. This is Sean Frothingham, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading for Are We There Yet?
Can't wait to get on the road again.